There is nothing American about it.
Maynard must have been drunk when he wrote it. Well, and then we have my old friend Granville Hicks saying, I hope it is clear that not for a moment can the novel be taken seriously as a portrayal of life in America or anywhere else. This is a make-believe world of Ian Fleming and Mickey Spillane. However, Maynard has a speak of pretentiousness to keep the book from being the good, dirty fun that Fleming's books, if not Spillane's, often are. I should like to believe that the novel is a hoax. But, this is a little later, if one rejects the theory that the novel is a hoax, one faces a distressing alternative. If one believes that Maynard intended an American dream to be taken seriously, one has to conclude that he has gone to pieces as a writer. Well, and then there's something from the Kansas City Star, which says, you'll forgive me, this is much more difficult to read because it's complimentary. It, for obvious reasons, it's much more difficult to say good things about myself in a position of this sort. Right? Anyway, I'll leave out some of the more extraordinary comments to say this. He is built out of the madness, the total disconnection of our national life, a tough, tight structure of ideas and images that is exhausting but explanatory, that elucidates the mysteries, even as it deepens them. Only the American language could handle the American nightmare. And here it is, the language American writers have worked toward for years, dirty and sorry, ruddy and compound, with Europe's fine meals and museums and concentration camps behind it, with New England behind it, with the Daily News behind it, with Faulkner and Hemingway and Dick Tracy behind it, with almost everyone behind it. I could then go on, I could read you a terrible review in the New York Times, and a very good review in Life, and so forth, but I think that these make a point. And that is, I'm going to ask the question, why did I read these reviews? Is it to sell books or what? Obviously not. I'm being vulgar. You'll forgive me. Now, I read these reviews to point out something, which is that I am a one-man minority group. And the reason I'm a one-man minority group is because I have to contend with two altogether opposed notions of myself at the same time, which is exactly what characterizes the Negro, the Jew, the Italian, the Puerto Rican, the Catholic, the Alaskan. That is, at what we are forced to consider ourselves at the same time as extraordinary and marvelous and awful and inferior. And this produces a different state of mind than the state of mind of people who inhabit the center of a culture. Now, of course, very few people are completely members of a minority group. That is, in other words, it's, what one finds is one begins to go through the dimensions of the psyche that let's say a Negro living in Harlem would be in certain ways a member of a minority group, absolutely, obviously. Yet, let's say if he's the leader of his small gang on his particular street, he's also a member of a group which wields power. And he's one of the people who wields the power. He's the center of his subculture. And let's say one of the kids who's on the fringe of the gang is a member of two different kinds of minority groups. He's a Negro, which generally speaking is a minority group. And he's also, since he's on the fringe of the gang, he is in a minority group as far as this little subculture is concerned. Now, the particular matter which comes to emphasis then is that if you're going to be anyone who's a member of a minority group who in effect is forced to consider himself a member of a minority group is forced to go through his life with a psychology different, profoundly different from anyone who lives at the center of a society, because the member of the minority group has to contain within himself a psychology which is divided, which is what I would call existential. Now, the great difficulty with using a word like existential is that it always causes people profound pain because no one quite knows what the word means. And they get awfully embarrassed, and they get awfully depressed, and they, generally college students, make mental notes, sit down finally and read Sartre, and so forth. But in fact, it's a great help if one recognizes that the word existential is a word which does not have a hard, precise meaning, like gold or silver or structure, but in fact is a word like God or life or death or growth. It's a word which one lives with one's entire life, and one tries to define its nature as one proceeds through life. In other words, once the word becomes real for one, you begin to go through life saying, well, yes, this is probably at least a, one's a collegiate style of mind, a scholarly temperament. You say, well, yes, this is probably an existential moment. In other words, I don't know how it's going to turn out. Sex, for example, is almost invariably existential, except in the unhappiest of marriages. Now, the point I'd like to make is that minority groups, because they inhabit, because they embody a conflict of cultures within themselves, within their very psychology, because their psychology is built not upon one rock, but upon two, which are sometimes dangerously far apart, people who are members of minority groups live an existential life. And what I would propose is the first rough definition of that, and please just accept one part of this, which is discard all notions of what Sartre has said, and what Heidegger has said, so-and-so has said, what the dictionary said about existentialism. Everyone who writes about existentialism, everyone who talks about it in a totally different fashion. And all you're going to get tonight is my small existential view of what, in other words, what I'm going to try to talk about is an existential view of minority groups, or what an existential view of minority groups might be. Now, everyone, I would say, that who is a member of a minority group spends their life redefining the nature of reality for themselves constantly. And this becomes perhaps the most subtle intellectual process of their lives. To take a practical and immediate aspect of it, ego, for instance, is always the touchiest and the most unendurable aspect of a minority man's psyche. Because his ego is always on an elevator. Everything that happens to him sends that ego going up and down. If he walks along the street, someone who is in a position of power slightly above him says hello in a manner which is slightly less friendly than the way perhaps he said the day before, and the ego begins to go down. You could say that this is also true of a small town, but I could return that remark by saying all members of a small town belong to a minority group. So they're small towners, they're hicks. You see, they're also the best goddamn people in America. So they have these two notions of themselves. They have the notion this is finally where God's vision resides in a small town, and they have the notion that they're not good enough to be in the big city because they just don't have it. By the same token, I've been in Alaska just 3 days, but I know enough about the state already to know that this state has more of a divided sense of itself than any state I've ever been in. New Yorkers never think of themselves as being in a state. We think of ourselves as being in a city. We think of a state as, oh, well, that's that crooked administration up in Albany. And then that's as far as it goes. We just don't think of ourselves as a state. There are people in Alaska who are willing to die for this state. You'd have to travel the length and the breadth of those 10 million inhabitants of New York State to find one man who's willing to die for New York State. That's because we're a member of a majority group in New York State. Majority groups tend to take their conditions, their existence, for granted. That's part of their existence, which is majority. Now, in this state, I know yesterday, I had the great good fortune of being on television with Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Skellington. And in the course of this, and with Mike Gravel, and in the course of this, I was asked my opinion of Alaska, and I said, well, I think it's probably going to become either the best or the worst state of the 48. And someone said, well, what about the 50 states? I said, no, we'll get rid of the other two. But forgive this joke, it's just that the extraordinary, exciting aspect of Alaska is the fact that the future of this state is altogether unknown, and it can end up becoming some sort of psychic leader for America, some sort of, if you will, even spiritual leader, or it can end up being the most garish aspect of a nightmare. you know, to Las Vegas, 60 degrees below zero. Now, I've gone on this great length about minority groups because there's one thing I feel about them, which is they're going to win. I think all the minority groups of the world are going to win. I think that's the nature of the 20th century. The Negro's going to win. The Jews are winning already. Catholics won just about. The Italians have just about won. They've got the mafia. It's a very powerful and subtle organization, which, you know, does much of the best and worst work done in America. The Alaskans may or may not win. The Russians may or may not win, and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that we are passing, I think, from a sense of countries as nations which had powerful centers, powerful cultural centers, and nations which were founded upon peril and risk, into another view of existence, which is that all men should be safe, all men should be secure. And this, of course, has always been the cry of the minority group, because they existed at the edge of that powerful society, and so recognized the extraordinary and burning inequities of those cultures which produced the Christmas Carol and War and Peace. And in the particular outrage that was visited upon them by the very piggishness of the rich, all minority groups of the world, you might say, in varying degree, the Asians, the Africans, the South Americans, what have you, formed a profound detestation of centers of power and wealth. The trouble is they also formed at the same time a powerful detestation of form, of distinction, of specific, elaborated, complex meanings. So that in the heart of this new revolutionary in the 20th century, there also existed the spirit not of that primitive who created civilization, who created all the artifacts and the great works of civilization, but existed instead the heart of a barbarian. And the barbarian, as opposed to the primitive, exists not for lore, but for, I would say, communication. In other words, mass communications are the expression of a barbaric impulse rather than a primitive impulse. But the primitive impulse is, I'm making this by the way, is a completely, it's a completely formal distinction I'm making. I'm not going to stand on the list and defend it anthropologically by saying the Kwaki Islanders are barbarians and the Trobriand Islanders are primitive. I don't know enough about that. I'm talking about it now as, if you will, as poetic metaphors about two different kinds of basic society, well, to which I think, out of which man's civilizations have come time and time again, and to which they keep returning. Now these societies, these notions, if you will, this difference, this distinction between the primitive and the barbaric is significant, I think, when you start talking about the coming victory, which I believe is going to happen, of all the various minority groups of the world in one form or another, because the impulse has become, if you will, barbaric, to wit, destructive, plague-like. The emphasis has moved very far from distinctions, has gone entirely, as I say, toward communication, toward telling everyone the same thing. It's equal to what in America is often called the age of conformity. I would say that America, in fact, has been a barbaric nation since the Second World War. And a barbaric nation because the particular crisis that affected the people who ran America was that they could keep their power only by taking a turn toward the barbaric. There was a recognition, I think, and I don't think the people who have enormous power sit around and discuss things this way at all. There is, after all, such matters as the communications of sleep. And when one has a dream, one can absorb the experiences of the day and come to a conclusion. And let's say that on a given morning, John Forster Dulles, back in 1956, could come out of his bed of sleep and could walk and see President Eisenhower, who would come out of his bed of sleep, the two of them just looking at one another without even thinking about it, would know in some sense that the other's ideas had come closer or gone further away in the course of the night. I think that when one talks of the power structure at the top, I think that's probably the way it works more than any other way. There's not that need for that much discussion. It's precisely all the poor minorities and upstarts that sit around talking to one another for hours. Now, this matter of minorities being inflicted with a plague is something that's profoundly unfashionable to talk about now, because we live in a liberal time. But there is, I think, that the deepest part of the danger and the difficulty is that this plague was inflicted upon minority groups from the top down. All minority groups of the world became, in effect, the refuse piles of capitalism. And when revolutions began to occur in the 20th century, the first horror that the 20th century presented was that precisely when the minority groups came to power, they were, if anything, even worse than the very capitalists they'd overthrown. Their societies were more inequitable, more barbaric, more hideous. And so the world was treated to the incredible specter of a powerful nation like America becoming more barbaric and more totalitarian day by day, presenting itself as a defender of civilization, a defender of civilized values, against a power even more barbaric than itself. And what gave irony and terror to the nightmare is that no one could ever say this wasn't even true. You see, one doesn't know to this day whether it's true or not. To this day, I don't believe there's anyone in America who can say with real conviction, anyone who's really studied these matters, lived with them, thought about them. I don't think there's any Russian who can say, really, I won't talk about the Chinese because I don't know anything about them, but I don't think there's any Russian or American who could ever say to himself, with true conviction, my country is right and the other country is wrong. There's a plague loose upon the 20th century. And this plague is a plague which is visited upon minority groups precisely because what captures the essence of the power hole is that they have had the particular wit and selfishness and self intensely enough to be able always to pass plagues downward. I mean, after all, one of the reasons people look to power so powerfully, so intensely, is precisely to get rid of the illnesses that visit them when they live at a lower level of society. Now, these plagues, as I say, that infest minority groups, are the problem, you might say, which confront anyone of goodwill who wishes to improve the world in which he lives. Because you might say the question of the 20th century, the final question of the 20th century, will be whether, as these minority groups come to power, and I really think nothing can finally stop them, nothing can stop the Negro from obtaining those rights he's been denied formally for a century and for three centuries altogether. Nothing is going to keep the Jews from having a complete equality, at least in their own mind, with WASPs. Nothing is going to keep the Catholic Church from becoming more and more powerful because its religion offers a sense of lore which is appealing and attractive against the mass communications of the new barbarism. Nothing's going to keep the small Asian nations from making the military life of the American more and more intolerable and unhappy. Nothing's going to keep the African nations from cooperating less and less with America. Nothing's going to keep South America in place. The world, willy-nilly, one way or another, is going to move into some new form of society. What's critical in that period, seems to me, is whether the minority groups that begin to obtain the power can arouse themselves and can purify themselves and can search themselves to a point where they can create something more beautiful and more noble and more courageous than anything that came before them. Because I think if they can't, we're doomed. One way or another, we may not settle atom bombs. We may just end up all dying of, in 100 years, may all die of various mutations of cancer that came about after drugs were discovered to cure cancer. Now, I've taken this, made these great sweeping remarks, and I've traveled around the world several times in the course of this conversation, because I want to make the point I think is applicable. Alaskans are practical people. As a practical people, there is something quite practical to be said at this moment, which is this state is truly a minority group. This state is perhaps the most beautiful of 48. There might be Californians and Oregonians and Washingtonians who would argue with you. There might be sentimentalists about the Spanish moss on the trees in Louisiana. There are a few diehards in Maine. There are those who say that New England has a greater sense of human scale than Alaska. But nonetheless, and they'd be right, but nonetheless, Alaska is a country which is, it is the only place I think I've ever visited in this country that gave me a feeling that this place is extraordinary. You know, it's very rare to get off a plane and say you're an extraordinary place. It happens to people once or twice in their lives. There's something in the air. Maybe it's that we're sleeping under the great shadow of the north. There's something about this country that says, has more to say about life, about nearness of death, than any place I've ever been. And it has extraordinary powers and qualities. And it also is an unbelievably vulgar and tasteless state. Now, this vulgarity. This vulgarity is not in the people who live here, because it takes time to become truly vulgar in your person. I mean, you have to have had 20 years of a very dull and mediocre sort of success to become profoundly vulgar in your person. And nobody I know has been here 20 years. But it certainly exists in the building. For instance, in this college, which I really didn't get a good chance to look at because when I arrived, it was dark, I saw nonetheless that part of the sheer insanity of American architecture has already visited this joint. For instance, you have flat roofs. Now, a flat roof in a northern climate is like having an open roof in a southern climate. It's absurd. The first primitive who thought of building a shelter and lived in a cold climate put two sticks up together like this, and then he put another two up there and he draped something over them because he wanted to keep the snow off. He wanted the snow to fall off instead of having to shovel it off. I won't go on and on because beyond this point, when we get to land of neon, I must say that having lived with pop art in New York for a long time, there's something about neon signs by now that's quite cheerful and charming. You say, well, my God, I'm in the museum again. The thing is, I wish to warn you, there are new horrors on the way. There's now an art called op art. And op art consists of various visual attacks upon your eyes. I'm not being facetious here because this is the notion of the artist, that they wish to affect you physiologically. And indeed, as you look at these paintings, what happens, because they consist of a very brilliant sort of salmon lavender red here, you see, and then a vomitous green. And I'm not being a Philistine. I mean, the point of the artist is he chooses these colors precisely for their intense dislocation of one another. And he draws it with a razor's edge. And he must just have these two lines repeating, you see. It looks sort of like a striped suit. Now, the idea is that this inspires you with a certain malaise. And if you look at some of these things longer, they begin to move. And after a while, you begin to realize what you're looking at. What you're looking at is very similar to the rings that you see in your closed eyes, behind your closed eyes, and they put an ether mask over you. You're being anesthetized. And that is on its way. I mean, that's coming to Alaska very shortly. Now, if you people were true patriotic Alaskans, you would meet this art at the border with guns. The difficulty is that you can't, because you already have pop art in the buildings you put up. Like, this is a very chaste version of op art, this gymnasium. Somewhat surgical. It could be a vast operating chamber. I used this image once before, but in fact, this could be used to operate on a whale. particular difficulty is just this, that you have buildings that are made with plastic materials. These plastic materials, for some God-given reason, or perhaps satanic reason, have colors which are always incompatible with one another. Now, I don't know quite why it is, but you take a series of pastel colors and put them on sheets of plastic and put them together, and they're always intolerable. I mean, it's a little bit as if one had taken a slightly sodden aspirin tablet. I mean, that's generally the feeling one feels when one goes into any lunchroom in this state. You know, you've got those plastic tables, plastic bar, you've got this plastic whirl where you put a drink down, it doesn't make a good sound. I mean, you can't wrap your knuckles on wood. You do it on plastic. Oh, that's good. I'm embarrassed. It's the best sound I've ever heard a piece of plastic make. At any rate, try it in places less felicitous than this. Now, of course, we're all having a grand time, but the thing I would try to say is that this state is unlike any of the other states. And for that reason, for those of you who are going to live here, there should be some conscious sense that the arts and the crafts of this state are terribly important. They're important anywhere, but they're triply important here. Because you are not like the other states. You're not like them geographically. You're not even connected to the body of America. You do not have the same relation to security that the rest of America has, because it will always be impossible to build a truly secure life here, since you have winters, for example, where you may have the temperature will go 40 below for 30 days in a row. Well, any man taking any short trip to visit a friend on any one of those 40 days and have his car conk out, and he is in danger of freezing to death. So there is a existential intensity to the life that's lived here. It is a frontier. It does have a quality, probably. It does recapture something that the Wild West had. Probably does not recapture it in any way in detail or in the intimate local character of what goes on, but it certainly does capture it in the mood. And this mood can produce an extraordinary and intense sense of Alaska and its art and its people and the way it does things that could end up revitalizing all the dead communications and the dead circuits of America. But that's going to be done only if Alaskans face up to what I think is the central problem, and if you will, even the central terror to anyone, and I'm sure there are many of you who love this state, which is that there's a piggishness lives in this state as well, and there's a greed, and there's an apishness to ape the manners of America, to get all those plastic buildings up here as fast as you can, to build big before you even know what it looks like, to get the monies in. That's all very fine, get the monies in, that's necessary, but there's got to be something moving concurrently with it, and that is, there's got to be a sense that unless this state is more extraordinary than any of the other states in this country, it's going to be the worst state. It's going to be the worst state because it's the farthest away from the center, and just in sheer problem of the mechanical difficulties, if you're trying to be like the center and you're farthest away from the center, you are obviously the most sluggish in your movement and the most frantic and feverish in your passing expressions. So to sum up, I think that the problem of the conflict of cultures, which always reduces itself, I believe, to a matter of saying what is the nature, the existential nature of a minority group, comes down to the crucial and painful and even agonizing center of what it means to be in one's heart a member of a minority group, and that is that one must be either more fantastic than what has been before, one must try every moment of one's life to improve and become more extraordinary, or one is always in danger of diminishing into much